This is a series on the woman's movement. Yeah, my crowd is going, so maybe I'll wait a minute.
One nice thing about you is...
It goes, oh, I forgot. I will introduce. This is my husband. I brought him. We're going to do a series next week together on the textbook. I'll give you the textbook name because I can't remember what you called the series. Oh, New Community of Women and Men in the Church. The textbook is Christianity, Patriarchy, and Abuse. And four women who wrote the four essays in that book, four chapters, are women theologians from the Pacific Northwest. So it has a lot of meaning to us who live here, because this is very avant-garde, and they're really going into a biblical interpretation and their perspective on Christianity. But I'm going to start, for the sake of some of you been in here, I'm not a good joke teller, but this is a very serious one that I started out. Oh, I think I saw it, this cartoon in the Saturday Review of Literature. So you know how long ago that was. That's out of business. In fact, it's been out of business so long I can use this joke in a newspaper. But it had a picture. It was just the beginning of the woman's movement and kind of getting us all excited. And there was this very stately woman at the door, hand on the knob, the door opening, dog on leash and bag on the other hand, and she turns to this bewildered looking gentleman who appears not to know what's happening, and she says to him, "Thus ends civilization as you have known it."
She's leaving.
Or changing. And that to me kind of tells about the woman's movement. In a nutshell, they are trying to tell men, and I attended many of those conferences. I was at Mexico City, Copenhagen, East Berlin. Would like to have gone to Nairobi, but couldn't that year. Maybe one reason, I had been arrested at the South African consulate, so probably I could never have gotten in anyway, because we had to go through South Africa. And I went with Bill to the New Community on Women and Men in the Church in Sheffield, England, the first grassroots conference held on the woman's movement by the World Council of Churches. It was the result of a long history, which we will do next week. But anyway, I want us to open with a statement. And then I hope to have a lot of discussion tonight. And Bill is with me because we're going to work together next year, as I said, next week, and this is kind of the beginning of that. The feminine principle is respect for life in nature and society. And that's very important up here because we're talking about women and we're also talking about ecology and the respect for nature. They're very closely related. Now, what feminism has given, and you may disagree with this, so stop me, but I'm going to list a few things. The feminist has grown, and this is more or less coming out of the feminist movement. They stress the dignity of the human person, the right of an individual to make choices. They recognize the right of the individual and the community to self-determination. They believe they are one with God. The people are one with God, men and women. And the feminist movement will also help men to be all that they can be, opening up the fullness of God. The feminist religious movement also believes in opening up the fullness of ourselves. And the feminist religious movement looks at the need for salvation in a different way. Feminists cannot move ahead unless they understand the barriers that stand in their way. Now, anybody like to make a little comment before I go on to what my impressions have been right here as we've discussed the whole week?
Well, the thing that has been discussed, at least in my sphere of attending there, has always been dealing with recyclables. And how does that fit in with the women?
Well, we're recycling men. If that's the biggest job, then most of us are very interested in that part of preserving nature, preserving the world. We look upon it as a, I'll read you. You know, where do we look upon it as a recycle? Excuse me.
I guess I would say that I don't believe that. I don't believe that women are very interested in it. And why do I say that? I say that because as a scientist, a physicist, I look at the number of women that are physicists. I go to the APS meeting or any other scientific community, and there are almost none.
No women there.
No women there, and very few physicists. Why is that?
Well, let's discuss that a little bit later, what that might be, why that might be. But let me read just a statement from an old feminist. And I say that because she may not have called herself a feminist, but she influenced women. And this is Barbara Ward, the economist. On this present course, people are in sober truth an endangered species. No planet can carry indefinitely the fright of population, aspiration, consumption, destruction, and exhaustion with which we are threatened, or which we threaten it. In fact, it is the planet itself that is desperately signaling us to us the millennial lesson of all the world's prophets and poets, that we must love each other or we must die. Survival is now simply the issue whether we can learn and change in time. Now that really has been the basis of my theme this week. Want to comment on that?
It seems like one of the main issues is cooperation. When we say survival is the issue, but it's women can see each other's point of view and, you know, do what they can to come together and solve some problems instead of a woman's movement rising up in response to, you know, how they felt for years. I mean, I think that, you know, if there were such a thing as a men and women's movement that is a combination of both, that's separate from a men's, separate from a women's movement, you know, the idea being that, you know, we're here to respect each other and to do something different than what we've known the world for.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me just look at this a minute, because I'm wondering, Bill and I have decided to do this together, and the next four statements were the impressions that I have received out here. And that's one of them that you just articulated, that we should be together in this, not some women moving out over here, but we should be working together. Now, let me give you a couple of other. There's some impression that was given that many women have largely closed their ears to the movement. Women like it the way it is in our communities and churches and trust men with the problems outside the home. And here's some that came out of last night. Women are whiny, sour grapes. They don't use the power that they have. Here's another one. Women are fearful of alienating men. Here's another one. There is an acceptance of the stereotypes and apprehensions of people opposed to the woman's movement.
Did you read that one again? Mm-hmm.
There is an acceptance among women and men of the stereotypes and apprehensions of people opposed to the woman's movement. Now, we've had a very outspoken person, Phyllis Schlafly. There are many people opposed to the woman's movement. She is one of the most outspoken. Would you care to comment on that?
I don't oppose. I don't understand it.
No, I still don't know what the woman's movement is.
We don't know what the stereotype is. I think that's
well,
the problem.
All right.
There's supposed to be a stereotype. Now, I personally don't know what it is.
Well, I can give you one example of a stereotype. It strikes me that men are really stupid in let women always raise the children.
You're saying that, wait a minute. Say that again. Is that a stereotype, or you think that's coming through?
No, I'll say what I said again. Men in our culture have always, I don't know, I'll be facetious about it, raising children, in my mind, is probably one of the most powerful positions that a person can have. Absolutely one of the most powerful. And yet men have ignored that. So I think they're foolish and stupid both at the same time.
Questions for us? Why have we done that?
Yeah, right. Next question. I don't quite understand how that evolved. And why somehow it was decided that was unimportant.
I guess I was raised in the wrong community.
Never thought. When I was a kid, I was brought up to believe that your motherhood was one of the highest things there is.
Right.
And if anything has been denigrated, unbelievably, this is part of my complaining about some of this.
Excuse me, could we call it a stereotype?
Yeah.
But I'm sorry, I disagree with that. I mean, if I look at the culture as it is now, with two parents working and trying to figure out what to do with their children, putting them into daycare, and the whole family situation is kind of chaotic right now. Why, for example, do women? Why is it a complete misconception that on the woman's part that raising children somehow was an inferior thing? Where did they get that feeling?
I want to tell a story here. I get mad all the time, and I was mad
last night,
and I was thinking about it. And this is a true story, and it happened when our children were little, so this was long before we ever heard of a woman's movement. And we had it, and understand, I'm from Pullman. All our people we know work on the faculty, essentially, or work for the university. And the truth is, every man, every husband, every woman in that community had a husband who had an income adequate to support him, okay? There was nobody, no woman in that community had to work out of economic necessity, not one. Now here comes a woman up to my wife, we got two little kids. My wife is home raising the kids. And she's got one of the nastiest little brats I ever saw in my life. That if you took care of that kid for a half a day, you'd be a living wreck. She comes up to our house and wants to have my wife watch her kid for 25 cents an hour. And she goes to the college and works as a draftsman of some kind, makes a dollar and a half. Now that's her estimation of motherhood, was 25 cents an hour versus a dollar and a half to go up there in peace and quiet and draw your little lines and this stuff and let her, my wife, take care of her kid. Now, I think I'm trying to make a point here. This is a woman's estimate of the relative value of working in the home and doing this chore here.
So how much time did you spend with your child from the age of one, let's say from the time he was 1 month old to the time he was 2 years old? How much of the care did you take of your own children during that time?
Well, that's hard to say.
I have held him once a day.
See, that's what I'm saying. That's one of the things that I'm getting at.
The truth of the matter is that young men and couples are really sharing much more than child care and the whole shebang. Some of it is out of necessity and some of it is out of intent. Mm-hmm. But we have a daughter her husband's a resident in a medical school, and she's also a resident. She has to be a year or so older than he is, so she decided that since they had a little baby boy, that she would go ahead, and he would stay home. And the second 12 months of this little boy's life, that he would raise him, and he did raise him. And I mean, he's a different little boy, much more aggressive. And we take him, he embarrasses his grandparents. he's a little over 2 and a half, and we went to see this Iranian friend we hadn't seen in a long time. And he walks up to her and kicks her in the shins. This woman has a little boy that's about a year and a half, and he grabbed it, got a half hold on his neck. Now this kid is aggressive. So, I mean, my opinion is that it is good to have balance training, and it's good that this little boy had his father to spend this much time with.
That particular thing could be the terrible twos. He wasn't around when I was rearing the children through their terrible twos, and that possibly. But the other thing is, it was a good experience for the father.
Sure.
Yeah, excellent experience for the father, and I think the little boy is more active. It could be. Took him to the zoo all the time. He can name all the animals. I ask him what he's like. Well, he names them. He took on to his father's interest. Well, the mother will come in then and have the child for a while, or the next child. And I don't think this is anything that's particularly proves the woman's movement. I think your point does, though, because I think that's a question. That is a stereotype of what is happening to the family. How valuable do women, how much value do women put on the family? How much value do men put on the family? How much value does President Bush put on the family, the society? All those questions are raised. I don't know whether that woman was working. Her husband, you said, had a full-time job, but she just didn't want to stay home with the children.
It was a lot easier to kill ourselves.
But it's still true today that for child care, you don't pay nearly as much as if you go out, so that hasn't changed.
Yeah. No, that hasn't changed.
And so what you said, it's more than 25 cents an hour,
this was almost 40 years.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Today, though, it's still that same discrepancy. You can go out and you can make considerably more than if you stay home and take care of
the child. That's how society values child rearing right now.
That's right.
It's not just child rearing, it's child education. Our children spend 6 hours of their lives every day with teachers, and yet teachers typically start at a salary of $15,000 to $17,000 a year. Personally, I think it ought to be a whole lot more than that. They have tremendous influence on children's lives.
Last year, the state of Washington turned down the Children's Initiative. We have been wanted daycare centers since 1969. They've never come, public care daycare centers. That's the national trend. Never have had the money to finance them. In the state of Washington, the majority of people who are carrying this load on their backs are single mothers, where generally the husband has not wanted to take that responsibility. He just doesn't want to be there. That's the majority of those folks. And it's very difficult to talk about family over against statistics. And I think that we've got a picture here that that is growing. You know, we've got the picture of all the issues that come into what is known as the woman's movement. When they met, the women first met in Mexico City, they had no idea of an agenda. Just kind of came out of there. Then each country involved, which most of the countries, Western countries, and Soviet Union, China, went back to their own countries and held conferences to make an agenda. And we did in this country. Many of ours are different than, say, South Africa, or the woman from India, or China, or Indonesia. They're different agendas. We had daycare, child abuse, abusive families, wife abuse. We had the problems of welfare. We had peace issues. We had international issues. We had, that was our agenda that we wrote up. Now, Bill, do you feel that it's time like to...
There's a little article. It's called The Male Journey, and it's an excerpt out of a book by Rosemary Radford Ruther, Sexism and God Talk. And what she does in this book, I think, is very interesting. She puts into two parts what she calls the male response to a woman's criticism of sexism. And the first step is trivialization and ridicule. I mean, let's face it, men have tended to criticize and ridicule the woman's movement. She says men really can't believe that women are an oppressed group. I mean, that's a good question. How many of you believe that women are an oppressed group? I think so.
On the basis of salary and that.
In some way.
But not like this one of your persons here.
Well, just, I mean, in some way.
In some way, yeah. Okay.
They are today, okay. Only by their own choice, though. Yeah.
But how many men are oppressed? See, we're both from the same boat.
Professors at Washington State University are not oppressed. Anyway, let me finish it here because I just got into it. They are convinced of their own benevolence. Men are convinced of their own benevolence toward women. Right? We're pretty good people.
You're crazy to call yourself wrong.
No, okay.
Good point.
I've been with these fellows most of the week, so. We got to know each other pretty well. Now, they individualize the issue and abstract and universalize the situation of relatively privileged wives. They claim that the women they know are well taken care of and ought to be happy and grateful. They are unable to see the stresses and vulnerabilities of dependency, even in this situation, much less the total system of sexism across classes and history. They laugh off the silliness of woman's lib, which she calls a trivialized diminutive used only for female and homosexual liberation movements. I don't believe that. Mm-hmm.
Consider the women well fed, and all we expect in return is a little loving and a good meal.
There's at least one honest man.
There's one honest man in here.
No, I would disagree with that.
Well, I think you would probably represent, this is just my estimation, a minority position at the present moment, but I do think there are men who do feel that way. I know that. I feel from that way. So that's one. The second stage of male response is co-optation. Men become aware that the historic polarization of the sexes is a real issue. They leap quickly to the thought that men too have suffered from sexism. Indeed, they have suffered equally. The men believe that men have suffered equally because of the oppression of women. Whole dimensions of their being, their ability to cry, to feel, to relate, to be sensitive, have been repressed in order to shape them for male roles of domination. They too need to be liberated. They need to recover the feminine side of themselves. This line is frequently adopted by clergy and other males who belong to the more humanistic disciplines and who find themselves marginalized from the centers of male macho power. Jungian psychology provides the intellectual a base for the male feminism. She goes on, I'll just quick statement. Such male feminists, she says, becomes very dogmatic about what feminism means. They soon imagine that they know more about it than women. In their identification of their own self, suppressed self with the feminine, they think they have a handle on women's true nature. They want women to cultivate this male definition of the feminine in order to nurture the feminine side of men. They purport to understand and sympathize with women, and no doubt sincerely think they do, but they tend to become very hostile when women suggest that this definition of the feminine is really a male projection and not female humanity. The male ego is still the center of the universe, which feminine is now seduced into enhancing in a new way. Such male feminists are sometimes worse enemies of woman's emancipation than outright chauvinism. Does that make sense to you?
You mean that you're trying to say we got to make room on the throne?
In those few words, it's just about that.
What they're saying is that some of us who claim we understand, we know what you're talking about, and that we have our more sensitive nature has been denied by the fact that we are a part of this male system. And a lot of truth in that.
On the other hand, this woman implies that she understands our situation, so I could see her in the same way.
Yeah, right. I know her husband, so she'd probably talk to him about it. But at any rate, we men, we are in a spot, right? There's a pressure here from a lot of women, not all of them, a lot of women. Point out to us how we've been, not purposely, see, but unconsciously, because we are a part of a system which has been in existence for over 5,000 years. Patriarchy, we call it patriarchy. And we act the way we do because this is the way we're taught. You know, I was taught to be macho, to play football and baseball and everything else. Probably the only reason I ended up being a minister was that my dad died when I was very small, and my mother was a very dominant force in my life. And so a lot of her sensitivities. I mean, for example, we lived on a little small acreage, and we'd have a lot of fried chicken because we'd lived in the South. And she would go out and chop the heads off of the chickens. She never would let us boys do it because she thought it would make us too bloodthirsty. I mean, she was, in her training, was to make us sensitive and be aware and not be violent and all that sort of thing.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Is there any precedent in the world for a feminine, well, make it strong, feminine dominated.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, sir.
There are matriarchal societies. Yes.
Yeah. How about equality? That's what I wondered. I wonder if there's ever been a time when if we are not equal, if there ever was a time in any culture when the men and women were equal. I question it. I doubt it.
I think there's a difference between saying something is equal and saying something is the same. I mean, there's equal importance of the different types of things that people have done throughout history in different civilizations. They are not necessarily the same things for each of the sexes, and they can't be necessarily interchanged, but there is the feeling that it is equal and that it is both important.
Well, the family is an organization, and in all society that I can think of, all organizations have to have somebody at the top and the structure goes on down. Now, you can have the mother at the top or you can have the father at the top, but I don't see how you can have them both at the top.
Can there be an equal relationship?
I think there is when either one of them is at the top. That's what I say. I hope you illuminate me because I don't understand
this.
Well,
you spell it wrong.
Yeah, this is when we talk top. Is that person passing
there
judgment?
There has to be one person that makes the final decision.
Oh?
No.
How about a small committee?
Huh?
How about a small committee? Or two?
Well, not even two. Sometimes it involves the children.
Yeah, it involves the children. Too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all committees have chairmen. Chairwomen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, actually, in the church, we automatically accept the hierarchy of doing business. Mm-hmm. And one thing I learned it, Jen and I went to Sheffield, England, and we were part of this process you mentioned called the New Community of Women and Men in the Church. And it was run by a Lutheran clergywoman, Constance Parvey, quite fine. And but they had this grassroots, they got, you know, people like us, and we were in study groups all over the world, some like 75 or 80 countries. And then they brought the theological, and they thought about all these issues, the relationship of men and women, and the ordination of women, whatever it was. And we brought together in a conference. And it was all done collegially. There was no big head, and I saw how you can operate without people having to have power over other people. Right? So for everything for the last, quite a few years, in my work in the church councils, we are collegial, non-hierarchical, decentralized, facilitating. Right? It takes a particular, that the mentality is always who's in charge and who's going to run this thing. Right? Rather than who's going to help the thing run. So that I think we can operate differently, and it seems to me a family is pretty much the same thing. You both have to kind of function together in an equal sort of way. You're going to have different talents.
In that situation, don't you seek out the talents of the people that are there? And
sure.
You find a person that's talented in a particular area, and that person becomes responsible in decision-making in that area.
That's right. One of the things that I think is difficult for women clergy, and all I do is hear about it, I'm not involved in it, but that I think it's pretty hard for women who are used to a more of a communal and, you know, relational kind of structure. It's hard for them to fit into a church structure that is used to the more hierarchical kind of way of doing business. At least why that's what I hear from a lot, because we have a woman clergy here, so she can speak for herself. At any rate, that's kind of my feeling about the whole hierarchical thing. And
next, and we can talk a little bit about it tonight, because I think it was a very important statement that Roland made, that men aren't going to give up power, he said last night. They're not going to give it up. We're going to keep it, all the power we have. And that may be true. So we're not going to get the power for decision making, he said, unless the women take it. Now that comes back to the young woman's question, is that I think men and women should be working together on issues, should work together on issues. The feminists are saying, we'd love to, but we're not in the decision making. We're not, the patriarchy system is still in the decision making. Now, this is not just the feminists in the United States, but when I first opened this series, I talked about this young woman from India who had written, same thing, just as Barbara Ward practically, just to stay alive. Women have to bring their talents into equal decision making. Because almost every decision that is being made does not take into how women usually function. Even if it's in the little farm or the little rural community in India. One of the big examples we used this week is in the Africa study. One woman asked the question, do are women in business in Africa? They're talking about black women here, and maybe others. And she said, well, yes, they have little businesses. The first things we heard in these women's conferences was that the Coca-Cola company was going all over the world, establishing this big multinational corporation of drinks, and all the women were losing their businesses that had their little lemonade stands in the summer or whenever or all year long. They went out of business. Think about it in this country. Do we include women's work in the home, since it's so important, in our gross national product? Do we include in the paycheck the fact that women might, who loves to stay home and take care of her child, and who makes that as a choice, like I did, I made it a choice. And I won't tell you how, I just decided, nope, this is my bailiwick, I'm going to stay here. But did they include the fact in the salary that I get up, prepare a lunch, have the clothing ready for the man who does go out and make the salary? That's not included in that. The experience of women in the home. I probably could manage a corporation. A corporation. Right now I'm managing a small corporation from having my business. I think I could go in and do it. I was trained in rearing all these children, and now we've got grandchildren, they're still coming in. And all the people from the churches and all the experiences I had as a homemaker in the community and outside of the community. I had opportunities that I made for myself so I could move. But I have no problems with staying home being a homemaker. I have a problem, and it pains me, when people say, you're just a homemaker? Or is that what you did? Or when I want to run for president of the United States, I put down homemaker. Well, why aren't you a lawyer? I have a daughter that's an attorney. I do a lot of guidance with her. She asks me opinions. And that's what I'm saying.
In response to your statement that is this included in the gross national product, it is, because you are part of a partnership, and the partnership income is included in the gross national product.
I am a part of the partnership?
Well, the partnership, your husband and the family is a partnership.
How did you figure that out?
Did the Church Council of Greater Seattle figure me in that salary?
Pardon me?
Church Council of Greater Seattle figure me in that salary? No, they didn't.
Your employer, if they see the partnership as a whole, has a certain income.
What happens when there's divorce then? The woman who...
How come I... Oh, yeah. Good point.
You know, what happens to that woman who has not had a job and all of a sudden they haven't built up any retirement funds, they've taken care of the children, and then goodbye.
Get a good lawyer.
I've handled those cases myself. How many people have called me and said, I am in the midst of a divorce. My husband has an airplane, he has this large home, and I know that I am getting nothing. I've gone through four attorneys.
And who are the poor people of the world, the women and the children? Mm-hmm. I think that's the message to us.
Mm-hmm. And who controls the major money in the United States? Women.
That's true. Anyway, I think I thought of something on this.
The women and the children, you say, are the poor people. I don't argue that, but their men more than likely are poor widows. If they are poor women, they are also poor men.
Now we're getting down to brass tacks here.
They're the single. They're the single.
I see what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. When you're talking about power, okay, I didn't realize I was always after power, but. Then I had much power. But let's say that I have an offer of a job in Pennsylvania. And I think it's better than the job I have. Or maybe I don't even have a choice. But anyway, I think that's a decision that should largely be mine. Okay? Now, here's my... we're going to buy a house, or we're going to fix up the house or whatever. Now, why can't the woman be the chief honcho? What I'm getting at is I think the husband can be number one on some decisions and the wife number one on other decisions. Because let's face it, if you're equal and this one says no and this one says yes, now what?
You compliment.
I mean true equality and it holds. I mean, you know, like the law or something. Now, you don't do anything. You're stymied.
Well, you have to.
My association has been just like you say. The man's the front, but the power is the woman behind.
I suspect that...
You're in the real estate business.
It is my association. Now, maybe it isn't in the world. All my friends and my family, my wife's the boss, but I'm the front of the family.
Let's hear from your wife.
That's not his wife.
Oh, you got your wife. Where's your wife?
Not his wife.
My wife knows better than to come here with me.
And you see how far mine sits away from me.
And she's been very clever in her own right.
I empathize because I'm pretty much that generation, and we have had to go through a lot of change, really. And I must confess that I did not go through it willingly or easily, but I had to because I was in a very vulnerable position in the church, and I had, as I told you last night, I don't know where y'all were there. My first, I had that experience, my first big moment when I became the president of the Church Council of Greater Seattle. I was the president and the director. So I chaired the meeting. And we had a women and religion coalition made up of very avant-garde women in the church. And they said they wanted to come and make a presentation, demands to the Church Council. And so I said, you come, and five of them showed up, and when they were ready to come, I said, who is your chairman? See, and they immediately began to work me over for several years until I had come around to a very high degree. But, I mean, we're in that generation, and we are not because we have bad intentions. We have the marvelous intentions, but it's simply because we are the result of a pattern of man's activity over the years. And we're now in a time when we have to look at it, see? And we have to look at it. And it's good for us to talk about it, because usually what I find is what we talk about in our generation, the following generation does, right? So I'm trying to empathize with you and where you find yourself in this situation.
There's something that puzzles me, though, about the word power. I don't know if I can explain it to people here or not. I've tried this before, and I think I failed. But I'll try again. I think, you know, when I hear you talk about power, and I've heard it talked about before, it deals with what the male a lot of times sees as power in terms of committee meetings and deciding on a particular topic. And we see that as, seem to see that anyway, as a power structure. I understand that. I think that that's true to some extent. But let me ask you a question, or let you reflect on something. To me, you know, go back to the children again. The place, a very strong place, where you, or power, where I think that your power is extremely strong, is in relationship with your children and the nurturing of your children. That, in fact, then in the future becomes the person, whether it's female or male, that makes the decisions that are important to you. So which is the most powerful? Is it the time and the relationship that you spend with people and educating them and teaching them about what you are about? Is that as powerful as anything that's done in committee or any decisions that are made afterwards? I think it is. And I always see that missing, that element, because it's not as clear, of course. But I think it's, at least in my own experience, it's a very, very important aspect.
Missing from where?
Missing in the sense of when we talk about decision-making, talk about where power is.
Well, you know, and I'd like to kind of comment on that, because in this week, I had trouble with that myself, because it seems like the division, what we think in our minds is a division between men and women's responsibilities. And so much of feminist literature emphasizes relationship, nurturing, loving, that has come out of the woman's side. And that what we see is this kind of a competitive, off to work, alienation from family on the part of the man. And I think back in my own family, and then the type of family we were rearing in the early 50s and later on 60s. And now they're saying that the man should learn, should experience some of these nurturing of children, and it's a relationship that women have always done. And it's very difficult when we express that if we don't really believe that that's a good quality, if that's a quality we want somebody else to do, and we don't want to do it ourselves, which is very often the impression I got from my mother, or my, from my father, from my grandfather, but not from my son-in-law, who suddenly had that year of nurturing and loving and caring and changing diapers and disciplining and helping this little fella grow. He became a different man too. He's, now maybe Sarah resents it sometimes because it, sometimes it is nice to make a decision. No, you're going to bed and now. When you have two people rearing a child, it does get a little more complicated, but it's a loving thing to see. He treated his dad. He loved. It was an all-day experience for him. It was a marvelous experience for him. It was a marvelous experience for his dad.
I feel good about what I see in many, many young families. I think it's much healthier than...
But our society doesn't allow for that. They wouldn't say, would you go to work 5 hours like you mentioned last night? And maybe your spouse could go to work 5 hours and together you would have enough money to live and get a home or whatever. Maybe not buy a BMW, but who wants that? We want loving families. We want to be in a loving family relationship, whether it's this little family, whether it's the community, whether it's the world community. And we kind of talked around this week, and I'm sorry for it because so much of feminist literature is now on emphasizing, as she left a little soon, the togetherness of parents and togetherness in the church, building something. But it does mean we got to drop some of our stereotypes and things like that. We got to say, well, maybe I wasn't right. Like, go ahead.
The name itself, you talk about feminine movement, the feminists. If you really wanted to work together, I would agree with whoever it was or whenever, it's the wrong name.
Yeah, that's what I
mean. It's not a good name. You need another name.
That was question number 5 down here. Why don't we like the word feminist?
That right there sets us apart. I mean, let's face it, you got a half, theoretically half males and half females. This is a feminist movement.
Why don't you like that word?
By definition, you've excluded half the people.
No. Why don't you like that? Why don't you like that word? Okay, so we have. Why don't you like that word?
Well, it's sort of...
It's an aggressive statement.
It's an aggressive statement. It's a divisive statement.
Against women.
But that's the way the movement had to start. I mean, it started 20 years ago.
Okay, well, let's get a new name on it.
Nothing wrong with that. Can you think of one?
Make it more harmonious.
Well, someone suggested womanist, which is coming out of the black community.
That's
what I say, no better. But... I don't understand why feminist is a bad word.
It doesn't bother me.
Anything with an ist on the
end. Yeah, like terrorist, fascist.
Okay, all right. How about feminine movement?
It sounds softer.
Oh. All right.
Feminine movement might conjure up a different
Right. You're absolutely right, you see. That's the reason they did it.
But they wouldn't like it because that's not aggressive. When I think of somebody feminine, I don't think of somebody, you know, that's going to come out here and chop.
Well, maybe we should start that name.
Okay. Come up with a new name and I'll publish it.
Women have to be aggressive.
Yeah, so do I.
That's what the man said last night. He said, take it over. You're going to have to grab it. And that may be what women have to do.
Me too.
I think it is a feminist movement in the sense that it's time for women to do something. We look to men to do it for us. Yeah. We really have to.
But we have to do it. If we're going to do it, that's probably the weakness of the feminist movement.
I don't agree with that entirely. I think that it's both ways. I go back to the original thing that I said. I think that men were foolish and stupid. For what they did. I mean, we accepted a role and we have accepted a way of of living that has been dictated by a few people. The kind of way that we work from 8 to 5, we accept an awful lot. And I don't quite understand why, you know, except that our priorities are all mixed up. Why do we accept the way
Making money is a top priority in our culture.
Yeah, it seems to me like it's a society of gray heads against a society of dark brown, black, blonde heads. Yeah. The gray heads, and I'm one of them. My observation, we sold 3-bedroom houses, 1 bath, 1-car garage.
Mm-hmm.
Mama stayed home and took care of the family. Now we sell 4-bedroom homes, 3 baths, right, family room, 3-car garage, a camper out somewhere apart, a boat somewhere apart. Mom and dad both have to work.
Right.
Yeah. Because they made that choice.
Have to work. Yeah, they have to work. They have to work to live better than we ever had it.
That's my observation. I figure that that generation has abdicated.
Yeah,
and
I think your observation is correct.
And what, let me just extend just a little further. She talked about the poor. There are only those who both he and she work and who both he and she are college graduates or semi-professionals or professionals that can afford that house. And the other people who could afford something cheaper, there's nothing on the market for them. Because the builders are only building that because they make the money. And for the others, they are building the apartment houses. And so we are becoming a society of landlords and tenants.
Right. You got that.
That was one thing I thought of last night, you know, after that thing in here.
I even passed it off.
In the department I used to work in, we have 2 young professors. I'm retired. But the 2 young professors that are male, that's all we have in that department, is 2 young ones. They're both married, they both have small children, both wives work. And one of them will tell you, we can't afford it, we can't make it on one, my wife has to work. And I can tell you this, they got a better car, they got a better house, they're doing just what you said. No, I'm not talking about women who have to work. I'm talking about they did this on their own free will. It was their own values, and their husband could support them, and they chose their way, and that's fine. What's the point?
Wrong or right, the younger generation wants more material.
There's 2 generations in
there. The kids get married today, they want what took us 25 years to accomplish.
Yeah.
Whoa,
that's right.
Whoa, now I like it. It's getting old time. Come back next year. I'd like to say, though, that before those types of statements are made, and they are true, there's truth to it, that you go back a little bit in history, folks, you with the gray hair, me too, when the way we grow up, you didn't have a chance to finish Willamette.
No, I didn't.
But I'll bet that many people in our generation who went through World War II had very little problem in making a good salary, particularly if they worked hard enough. The jobs are there, the engineers came, the Boeing. I live in Bellevue. That didn't exist before World War II. That existed after World War II. And who moved in? All the GIs who got that wonderful education, and money came and money flowed, and they gave their children everything that they didn't have in the Depression. That's and right. Now you expect right. those children to want less? That's pretty difficult to sell. So with that, I'm going to leave you now. You can mull that over, go back and read your statistics and see what it is. You want the last word?
This is a feminist movement.